Good afternoon, everyone. I'm opening a meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee on Tuesday, May 5th, 2015. Welcome. We're going to go ahead and start with our public hearing today. So I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 249A. Beth, can you please provide us with the description of this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 249A would allow payments for off-site compensatory mitigation credits to the Oregon Removal Fill Mitigation Fund when credits from an improved bank were not available in a region at the time a first payment was made to the fund and expenses associated with the Department of State Lands Mitigation Bank project in the region have not been fully recovered by ESL. There's no revenue impact and minimal for this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I think we have Bill Ryan from Department of State Lands. Welcome. Please go ahead when you're ready.
Good afternoon. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Ryan. I'm Assistant Director at the Department of State Lands. And thank you for the opportunity here to testify for Senate Bill 249A. I'd like to provide a little bit of background for this. The Department of State Lands are responsible for implementing the state's removal fill law, which requires permits for removing or filling material in wetlands and waterways of the state. And the Oregon legislature gave us that responsibility with the original removal law in 1967. If a project's impacts to wetlands cannot be avoided, we require through the permitting process for the applicant to compensate for wetland losses through some form of mitigation. And by mitigation, I mean restoring, creating, or enhancing wetlands on a property, and so to replace the wetlands that are destroyed or lost through the development project. There are different options for mitigation. They include on-site mitigation, which is actually doing that replacement actually on the project site where the removal fill activity occurred. There's off-site mitigation, finding another property somewhere in the vicinity. An entity can purchase credits from a mitigation bank in the area of the project, or if there is no mitigation bank available, they can make a payment to the department's removal fill mitigation fund in order to offset that impact. And a mitigation bank is a property where wetlands have been restored, created, or enhanced in advance in order to provide mitigation for multiple permits over time. So instead of doing one mitigation site, they're actually doing it in advance with the intention of serving multiple permits over some period of time. The bank owner generates mitigation credits, which can then be sold to applicants for projects in that vicinity. And the use of a mitigation bank is often preferable because mitigation banks tend to be more successful in replacing wetland functions and values. They tend to cost less, and they offer more certainty regarding scheduling, and they also allow more rapid issuance of permits because you don't have to go through the whole process of identifying a mitigation site, purchasing it, designing it, and getting approval for that design. For this reason, there is a market for private mitigation banks in areas of robust development, which generally in Oregon is the Portland metro area and the Willamette Valley. Most of Oregon's 25 private mitigation banks are in those two areas. However, there's still a need for mitigation bank credits in areas that are not served by existing for-profit mitigation banks. And so, for example, the Oregon Department of Transportation has recognized that it has needs for wetland mitigation in various parts of the state that don't have a lot of development. You know, the highways need improvements and maintenance, et cetera, in areas that basically don't experience a lot of growth. And so they actually have developed their own banks in Medford, Klamath Falls, Prineville, and also in Hillsborough. And so the Department of State Lands, through our in-lieu fee mitigation program, actually provides credits in areas where others have not. And so we provide this valuable service, which is actually, you know, important for private development and local governments because it facilitates economic and infrastructure development while providing improved environmental outcomes. So it's a service that the state provides. The department accomplishes this by selling credits to permittees and then pooling those monies to develop mitigation projects or mitigation banks in those areas to offset those impacts in those areas. To date, we've been able to fund 6 wetland mitigation projects, including Forest Grove, Douglas County, Lincoln, and Clatsop counties, and also the Tillamook area as well. And once again, these are credits that we've provided in areas where there isn't a private mitigation bank for folks to access the credits from. The Removal Fill Mitigation Fund is replenished through the sale of mitigation credits, and those funds are used to create more mitigation credits in new areas. The reason for Senate Bill 249 is to address a problem in the current statute. ORS 196.643 allows payment into the mitigation fund only if there are no credits available from an established mitigation bank in Oregon. And the intent of that statute is to prevent the department from competing with the private sector, and with under the assumption that the department might be able to provide mitigation credits less expensively than the private sector. And this was not a problem until relatively recently. In 2010, the department funded a mitigation project in the Tualatin River watershed, Hillsborough area, in response to demand from applicants. And we invested $797,000 into a large-scale mitigation bank because there was a lot of demand in that area. In the following 14 months, the department was actually able to sell 2.11 credits to seven permittees, and we recouped about $150,000. Unfortunately, after that, in 2001 and 2011, we had two private mitigation banks that were created in that same watershed area. And so we are no longer able to basically access or sell those credits. And so we have roughly $600,000 locked up in that mitigation bank. And so that results, you know, that $600,000 that we're selling those credits, be able to take out and invest in new areas. So that's a disincentive for the department to invest in new watersheds, basically. So Senate Bill 249 would allow the department to sell mitigation credits in a watershed until we recover our investment costs, but the change would not affect the established private sector bank, so it really wouldn't affect that area in the Tualatin River Valley. And it would only apply in areas where the department actually sold credits before there was a private sector bank there. And so thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you. And this did pass unanimously out of the Senate. It was
29-1. What's it?
Okay.
Pretty close.
Mm-hmm, very close. Any questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you determine or explain the costs? Who puts the price tag on a credit?
Yes, Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson. Actually, a statute actually determines what the state can sell a credit for, and so the current statute is basically if we have a project already identified in design, so we know how much the per credit cost would be, we basically just sell it for cost. In an area where we're actually still pooling monies and have not identified a mitigation project, then we base the credit costs upon what our estimated costs would be based upon local land values and labor rates, that sort of thing. And then for the private sector, the costs are determined basically by the market.
Hello.
Thank you. So the intent here, as I understand it, is to try to make these credits or these mitigation funds available more geographically, let's say, representative of the state, right? So that developments and or activities in certain parts of the state wouldn't be held up just because there wasn't the availability of some way to mitigate a project, whether it's you mentioned ODOT, could be that, could be a commercial project as well. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, that's correct.
So the one project that I'm familiar with in my neck of the woods would be, it's in the Dalles. It's actually in Representative Huffman's district where Walmart has been trying to put a site of super center on the west side of the Dalles for a long, long time. But DSL has determined that there's this little quirk of nature called a vernal pool that exists, which is basically puddling that happens on basalt rock at certain times of the year, and not even every year. And somehow there's a little brine shrimp that exists for some period of time. Maybe it's 2 days or a week or 2 weeks. But anyway, they had to mitigate that and had to try to replicate it. And it's just very difficult to do that. So, in other words, there wasn't a way to mitigate the potential consequences of the project. So is the intent behind this to try to help make available those sorts of resources to where we could have much more timely process and permits for development such as this?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, most certainly.
Thank you.
Representative Holvey.
Thanks. Can you explain, how do these private mitigation banks make money?
Chair Peterson, Representative Holvey. The way they make money is essentially they do a market analysis look at, within a given watershed, what kind of development. They actually asked the department for our permit records, how many permits have been issued over X amount of time, and how much mitigation was required of that. And then they look to see if they can acquire property and then restore or enhance wetlands in those areas in a way that's cost effective. And the and generally they're able to do so if there is a relative amount of demand over time. And the cost of doing individual mitigation for especially for small mitigation, the per acre cost for mitigation is quite expensive because there's acquisition, design, maintenance, and just sort of a baseline construction cost associated with it. In doing a mitigation bank, there are economies of scale because all that work is applying to a much larger area.
I have a question to you. What percentage of the mitigation that needs to happen actually falls into the folks who need to actually use the removal fill mitigation fund versus like the on-site or the off-site or the purchasing the credits from existing banks?
Madam Chair, I don't have that figure off the top of my head. I can say that the removal fill mitigation fund is really important in areas where you don't have private sector banks yet. And so the North Coast comes to mind. Also, we're starting to see some demand down in the Umpqua watershed, and we've actually sold some advanced credits down in that area and are actually actively looking for a project now to create credits in that area. And our most recent investments have been in the North Coast, actually.
Any more questions? Okay, thank you very much. The only other person I have signed up is Mark Nystrom. If there's anyone else who'd like to testify on this bill, you can come forward right now. And we did check. Representative Widener, it's 30-0.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, Mark Nystrom, Association of Oregon Counties. Counties, as you all know, are responsible for the county road program and at times have a need for this wetland mitigation. We really think that this is a great idea. We feel like it would provide some wetland mitigation in areas where there isn't currently wetland mitigation. And we feel like they've put in enough safeguards to protect the private folks, and so we're highly supportive of this bill. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. All right. Since no one else is here, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 249A, and we'll open a public hearing. Representative Hurd is not here yet. So we'll go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 263A. And Beth, can you provide a summary of this bill?
Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 263A would make changes to the program elements that may be used by cities and counties to fulfill requirements to implement recycling programs. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you so much. And it looks like on this bill we have Abby and Peter. Thank you. Welcome. Please go ahead when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Chair Vager Peterson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Abby Baduras. I'm a legislative analyst with the Department of Environmental Quality. And with me here is Peter Spindelow, a waste reduction specialist with DEQ, who was integral in developing Senate Bill 263. We're here to testify in support of Senate Bill 263. In December of 2012, following extensive stakeholder input, the Environmental Quality Commission adopted the 2050 Vision and Framework for Action for Materials Management in Oregon. The 2050 Vision serves as Oregon's integrated solid waste management plan as required by statute, and 263 stems from that newly adopted vision. The 2050 vision consists of two parts. First is a vision that Oregonians produce and use materials responsibly, conserving resources, protecting the environment, and living well. It sets a clear picture of Oregon in 2050 when our production and use of materials is sustainable. The second part of the document is a framework for action, which lists actions that will help Oregon achieve this vision, this positive vision. Among the actions in this framework include establishing new goals for materials management and updating existing goals, increasing recycling collection opportunities through review and update of Oregon's Recycling Opportunity Act, and evaluating options to direct materials to their highest and best use, and also to develop a strategy to increase recovery of materials that have potentially high environmental impacts. To help guide us in implementing that framework for action, in 2013, DEQ established the Materials Management Work Group to provide recommendations for updating the recycling opportunities and goals and to establish stable funding. These efforts involved more than 100 stakeholders and 22 meetings held over 14 months. And then last year, we held 35 additional meetings in almost every county of the state with our partners, and the recommendations and the feedback we got resulted into two proposals, Senate Bill 263, which is before you today, and a companion bill, Senate Bill 245, which is over in Ways and Means. Senate Bill 263 would modernize Oregon's recycling laws and update the program goals. Oregon has made steady progress over the years in recycling and composting. Recycling saves energy, it reduces pollution, and it creates more jobs than landfilling. For example, expanding the bottle bill to include water bottles directly led to the establishment of the Orpet recycling facility in St. Helens that employs 25 people. But many high-value materials are still being thrown away. With more than a third of our disposed waste being potentially recyclable, and opportunities to benefit from reducing waste in the first place is often missed. Cities and counties are held to standards that were largely written into law more than 20 years ago, and state goals are also out of date. You will notice that this is a very long bill, and it looks like it has a lot of new language, but most of it is actually not new. Legislative Council is using this bill to update the statute, so a lot of stuff is just actually moved, cut, and then pasted back in. So we will highlight the actual changes for you to help you see where that is. But first, just a little background. The 1983 Recycling Opportunity Act that was amended in 1991 was built on the premise that everyone in Oregon should be given the opportunity to recycle. This is provided through en route recycling in the urban growth boundaries of cities with populations of 4,000 and more, and at recycling depots associated with disposal sites in more rural areas. In addition, cities of 4,000 or more and counties serving the urban growth boundaries of areas of those cities are required to implement programs such as weekly curbside recycling, yard waste debris composting, and business recycling. Cities and counties are required to implement between 3 and 5 programs depending on their size. I'll now turn it over to Peter Spindola to go into the specifics of the bill.
Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee, I'm Peter Spindola, as always, reduction and policy analyst for Department of Environmental Quality. And I'm 5 days short of 30 years of working on this particular issue. I first started out before the Recycling Opportunity Act went into effect in 1986. It passed in 83, went into effect in 86, and I started working on with local governments on implementing that. So Senate Bill 263, again, as Abby said, updates our recycling laws. It provides greater flexibility to smaller and more rural communities. It updates requirements to reflect current conditions and eliminates some of the less effective programs that were in our law to begin with. As Abby said, cities that are over 4,000 need to choose a set of recycling program elements from a list of 9. They have different numbers they choose based on their size. We are including 4 new elements, things that were not thought of back in 1991 when these were first put together. So we're giving more choices for communities as to the different programs they can do. But at the same time, for the larger communities and those nearer to recycling markets, nearer to Portland, we are increasing the number of elements that they're required to choose. But for the more rural communities, ones that are far from Portland, far from markets, we are keeping the number the same. Even though we're adding new options, we're keeping the number that they have to implement the same. And so they have more choices to what they do. And then one of the existing elements we are proposing to change a little bit, and that's the program element for extended recycling education and promotion, that as we've moved to commingled recycling now, we're seeing a lot more contamination, a lot more things going in people's recycling carts that don't belong there. And so we thought it was appropriate that in the education promotion, we should see education promotion regarding what really belongs in there, what doesn't, regarding contamination, so we can try to reduce the amount of contaminants that people are putting in their recycling, which lowers the value and makes it worse for all of us. We are also looking at one aspect that was not dealt with very well in the original law, and this is dealing with multi-tenant recycling, places where people rent property. They rent apartments, other sort of multifamily, and also strip malls and things like that. The law requires that everybody who has garbage service be provided the opportunity to recycle. And what the interpretation was made that means the landlord has the opportunity to recycle, but the landlord doesn't necessarily have to provide that to their tenants. In most cases, they do that, but in a number of cases, they don't. And so we thought that everybody should have the opportunity to recycle, and so we're proposing to extend that to all people, regardless of where they rent or own. And another thing that's in Senate Bill 263 are what we call the new waste prevention and reuse program elements. So this is new programs. They really affect only the larger cities, and the larger cities are the ones that have a certain number of program elements that they're going to be required to do out of this new list. But in both cases, in the case of the recycling program elements and these new waste prevention and reuse program elements, almost all cities are already doing what is going to be required of them. Currently in Portland, in the larger metropolitan areas, they are required to implement either 4 or 5 program elements, depending upon which ones they choose. We're going to add 3 to that list, but in almost all cases, the cities are doing far more than is required, and they are already meeting those requirements. So even though we're adding new program elements, under existing programs, they're meeting to implement what's required. So the other thing which we are looking at, again, is updating state and local recycling goals. Goals signal what is important. In our experience, they're powerful when they help people understand and work together to achieve a shared outcome. In statute, we currently have a number of goals related to materials, statewide and local recovery goals, and statewide waste generation goals. We measure progress towards these goals annually and provide feedback to our partners across the state. We produce a regular report telling them where they are relative to these goals. The goals were last revised in 2001, and many have expired. Modernizing the goals will better measure environmental outcomes and guide the state and local and private actions to increase and improve material recovery and to prevent waste. So here are the following changes we make in the goals. First, we are looking at increasing the statewide recovery goal to 52% by the year 2020 and by 55% by the year 2025. These goals are designed to be achievable and are modest in comparison to the goals that some other states have adopted. Second, as Abby mentioned, we are looking at establishing goals for 3 of the more important materials for recovery: food waste, plastic waste, and carpet. These materials are ones that have potential for significant environmental benefits if recovery could be increased. Third, the bill has been updates all of the local, the county or watershed goals. In every case, the goals are the ones that the county has itself decided upon. And so Another thing is that the goals will be voluntary under this. There will be no enforcement mechanism. We wanted the counties to look aggressively at what they could do, and we didn't want them to have the potential for regulatory consequences if they failed to meet the goals. So we decided it would be best to have voluntary goals. Fourth, the bill would authorize the EQC to adopt alternative methods for reaching recovery goals, ones which are based on environmental outcomes, such as energy savings. And what this does is it makes it so the local governments can work smarter to achieve the same sort of environmental benefit rather than working harder. So maybe they will not go again, try to get a lot of the materials which are really, kind of inert materials. They don't provide much benefit for recycle, but they will go after more of the high-value materials, the things we're talking about, like plastics, metals, food waste. Those are the things that really have a lot of value and that have the most impacts for getting those recycled. The bill also updates Oregon's statewide waste generation goal. And finally, the bill eliminates three of these credit programs that were established in 1997 that create a lot of confusion and parts of which were not very effective. So we're replacing those with the waste prevention or use program elements.
Abby? Thank you, Peter. So the bill as first introduced had broad but not full support from our stakeholders. So in response to outstanding concerns, we developed amendments that were adopted by the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. And we achieved broad and really complete stakeholder support because of that. For example, the carpet recycling goal was pushed out from 2020 to 2025, but then raised to 25%. And that was in response to concerns from the waste industry that they felt like more time was needed to establish facilities and capacity to recycle carpet here in Oregon. That change and the other amendments that were made over on the other side are shown here, and those changes resulted in full support from our stakeholders for this bill, many of whom I think you will hear from today or you receive testimony from. So that's a high-level overview of 263. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. Peter and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And I would say that there's also a fact sheet about this that goes along with the presentation that's on OLIS that helps go through some of the highlights of the program and their frequently asked questions. Do they have any questions for this panel? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for all your work on this. I noticed there was a series of no votes in Senate. Can you give us what the objections over there were?
I'm not sure. Honestly don't know what the objections were. They
If you don't, that's fine.
Follow up.
So the phrase proposing to extend the opportunity intrigues me. Perhaps you can share with me what that means, proposing to extend the opportunity. Who's extending the opportunity?
The law requires that everybody who has garbage service must be provided an opportunity to recycle. It doesn't require anybody to recycle. It just says that they need to have that opportunity. And so it's cities and counties are the ones now that originally it was listed as just the affected persons, which could be anybody, including the garbage haulers. Changes in the law in 1991 changed it, so it's cities and counties that are required to make sure the opportunity is provided. But they usually do it by working with their franchise garbage haulers to have the garbage hauler provide the opportunity, or in the case of disposal sites, it's the disposal site operator who will establish a depot at the disposal site so that when the public comes in with their garbage, they also can drop off their scrap metal here and their plastic here, whatever materials are recyclable in that location.
Follow up. Right. And so the proposing to extend the opportunity means we're imposing upon somebody the obligation to extend the opportunity. So who is the EQ imposing that requirement upon in this bill?
It's the requirement for providing the opportunity, again, is on the cities and the counties. They are the ones responsible to make sure that that happens. They don't actually necessarily do it themselves. Again, they usually do it through working with their franchise garbage haulers or with the disposal sites that have permits and passing those as part of giving a franchise, as part of giving the unique opportunity to provide garbage collection in this area. They are also required to provide the recycling collection in the cities of over 4,000, for instance.
Follow up. The reason I find the phraseology intriguing is because I wouldn't call it so much unique as mandatory. And so to me, it's not reflective of exactly what's going on. And I think that it would be better if we phrased it in a way that explains to those who's paying for it, the ratepayers, what's happening. So rather than extend the opportunity, we should say we are imposing upon those who collect your garbage the obligation to do certain things for which they're going to charge you more. So to say that we're going to extend to you the opportunity is a little misleading, don't you think?
As far as the citizens look at it, it's a matter of semantics. But you're right; it is a mandatory thing that the cities, that the service has to be provided to those people, and there is a cost to that. There are benefits to it also. You know, we've seen when it first started out. Again, when I first started in 1985, the programs were very ineffective. The amount of participation was usually on the order of 10% or less. But we've seen through what we've learned since then, you know, putting things to economy of scale, a very big increase in the amount of participation, and with that, a very big decrease in the cost of providing those services. So,
okay, if I follow up, I may.
Follow up.
Okay, so it's not a matter of semantics, because semantics means you're talking about the same thing differently and using different words for it. That's not what's going on here. Calling something an opportunity when in actuality it's a mandate, that's not semantics.
Yeah.
So what I want is you to tell me if you think the department is being clear in explaining what it's doing in this bill when it uses phrases like proposing to extend an opportunity.
Again, the bill very clearly puts a mandate on the cities and counties to provide those services. But the services they provide are the opportunity for the citizens to participate. It does not require the citizens to recycle. And that's the bill itself was called the Recycling Opportunity Act back in 1983, and that's the name which has stuck with it. But we changed the law in 1991 to specifically put that requirement on the cities and counties. And again, there are costs associated with it. There are sections of the bill, which we are not changing, but those sections are still there, that direct that the persons providing that service must be provided with the revenue through the rate setting, which means increased costs on the citizens. You're right, that's true. It's the compromise that was made back then, and it's one that people seem to be pretty happy with.
Follow up, if I may. Okay, so I am not unhappy necessarily with the outcome. I'm merely questioning the descriptive phrases you're using, because they seem to me to be misleading. Because the opportunity suggests that somehow they're not paying for it, or that we're not. And to me, it's important that we remind folks that they must pay for that which they get. It's not free. And so to me, the better approach would be to say, we are going to require you to pay 5 or 6 cents more a month. And in return for that requirement, you are going to have some choices. But you are going to pay more, mm-hmm. as opposed to we're going to give you this wonderful opportunity. It just seems misleading to me. One last question for the moment.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. You indicate that you're suggesting that recovery goals be increased to 52%, 55%. I think I have those right. Mm-hmm. And I didn't hear from where we are now and where we are going. So we need to know that. And then secondly, what is the enforcement mechanism if we don't reach those goals?
Okay. The recovery goal currently is 50%, but is with including some credits that actually makes it effectively only 46%. We are at 50% as measured directly right now. We're over 50%. So again, it's a modest increase to go from 50% to 52% by 2020. And there is no public embarrassment, I guess, is the only enforcement mechanism I can think of. There is nothing that happens if we fail to meet the goal. It is simply a goal. But we found that goals are effective at concentrating people's attention, and so that's why we've asked the local governments also to adopt their own goals. But you're right, there is no enforcement mechanism.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your exchange with our good representative that represents half the state or more. But I want to get back to the cost basis again, because I think one of the new additives in this updated plan related to multifamily collections and so forth. Prior to this plan, let's just say the landlord is not required to provide the receptacles. Is that correct?
Part of this plan, that is correct, that the landlords were the ones who were offered the opportunity to recycle, and they could determine that they didn't want to have that. They didn't want to have recycling receptacles on their property, and that meant that, of course, the tenants wouldn't have a way to recycle.
That changes under this proposal, correct?
Right. It changes. Let me give you a little bit more history, though, because to try to address the multifamily, one of the existing program elements is multifamily recycling, and roughly about two-thirds of the population live in areas where the recycling opportunity must be provided. The jurisdictions have chosen the multifamily. So we have a lot of multifamily recycling going on. There's about a third, though, which does not have that. And even in those places, they're still, it's offered to a number of places, it's just not offered to everybody. But we know there are a lot of issues relating to multifamily recycling. There is the cost, but there's also the contamination issue, that the material tends to be more contaminated. And so what we did is we set this is something which will only go into effect in July 1st of 2022. That gives us a lot of period that we are going to be working on this issue, trying to figure out how to reduce the contamination, best management practices, things that will get to allow this to be smoother, not only in the places which don't have it now, but especially in the places that do have it, to reduce that contamination. And we also added a provision to report back to the legislature in 2019 as to how we're doing, so you can get an interim of how we're addressing this before we get to 2022.
So there will be costs. We will agree with that. There will be increased costs to the landowners, which in turn will be passed on to the renters, correct?
Yes. Hopefully it will not be very high, though.
What's the magic number about 5? Why not 6 or more or 7 or more?
Program elements?
No. Units of multifamily.
Oh, 5 per month.
Yeah.
It is because traditionally units of 5 or more are picked up through commercial programs and departments. Units where they're less than 5, those are almost always included in the single-family residential collection. And so they are already being provided. So that is just the standard that the industry has, that 5 or more units they deal with is through their commercial collection program. And it makes sense, for instance, to offer one depot for all the, for 10 or 15 units, there'll be a place where those people can bring their materials. Where if it's only like 3 or 4 units or something like that, they can just pick it right up as though we're single-family residential, and that's what they do.
And as we talk about stakeholder involvement, Paula, thank you. Landlords and Tenants Association participated or were consulted on this change?
We went and talked to them, after the original state, or while we were still in the process of taking it out to the communities, we presented this to them.
Follow up. In your testimony, you mentioned that you eliminated a few less efficient programs or maybe programs that weren't working as well. Could you talk about what those might have been, what was happening previously that will not be happening going forward?
This was what we call the 2% credit programs. That it was a change in the law made in 1997 that we're trying to give incentive to provide some things for which there's actually no measurement of material recovered. So, for instance, waste prevention programs and reuse programs and home composting programs. If a city or county implemented those, they got an additional 2% added to their recycling rate. Well, the thing was there wasn't actually any material you actually collected there, and it just made it kind of a strange thing that it wasn't a really recycling rate. So we proposed to eliminate that, but to keep the best parts of those programs, and that is what the new waste prevention and reuse program elements are the best parts of that. But we thought that would really only be appropriate in the larger jurisdictions, the ones that had the means to do these sorts of programs. And again, all the ones places which we've put these we say that they need to have some of these elements, they are already doing those based on the current 2% programs. They're doing enough to satisfy our new requirements.
One final question I just have to ask. It's just you're going to expand the opportunities as we put them in Portland as well, or mm-hmm. in the Portland metro area for additional materials and so forth. which would mean additional curbside containers, I'm guessing, correct?
No, we're not adding any additional materials.
Okay.
So
the reason I asked is I just wondered if you'd alerted the Portlandia producers in case they want to do another episode.
No new bins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No more questions.
Thank you. They are always happy to do more episodes for Portlandia. We love those jobs. Any further questions for this panel? Representative Holby.
Thanks. I'm one consumer that appreciates the opportunity to have curbside recycling. Granted, I probably pay for it as well, but I am curious about the potential for an additional bin of regarding food waste, where food waste can be separated out, and wondering whether there's programs like that that are considered for some of the urban areas.
Yes, food waste, particularly from large commercial sources, is something which is very often collected separately. You know, Portland has that. A number of different jurisdictions have commercial collection of food waste. Portland has moved to collecting residential food waste in the same bin as the yard debris. And doing that is a great thing in one sense because it's very efficient. You don't have any additional collection trucks running around and so on. The problem with it is that there are only a limited number of composters who can take food waste that contains things like meat scraps and so on. And so we've really limited where those materials can go by adding those food waste to those bins. So this is one of the things that we really need to work on, is developing more composters who have the ability to handle more materials and not just the yard debris and what we call the green waste. And so that's really where we're seeing things go. I think in some of your districts, they have food waste collection, which is just the non-meat type of, you know, the vegetative scraps people can throw in with their yard debris. But in Salem and in Portland, we see, a broader collection of materials. And Portland definitely has issues. You know, we have to send a lot of our food waste far distances, including all the way down to your near your district, in order to handle a lot of our commercial food waste, because we simply don't have the composters in the Portland metro area to do that. That's an area we're continuing to work on, along with Metro and other jurisdictions.
Follow up. Are they working on the concept of having food waste separate from the yard debris?
I'm not sure what jurisdictions have that. Again, it's more the concern that people have is additional truck, additional expense, and so they've been trying to keep the cost down by mixing it in with the yard debris as far as residential is concerned. Again, the commercial is where you generate large amounts from, you know, grocery stores and those sorts of entities, and that is stuff that is collected separately because it's got higher value, and that's a lot of material which is going down to the facility in Junction City, for instance.
Thanks.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, I have a couple questions. So there's a part in here in section 15 where it talks about the waste originating outside of Oregon. Is that a new section, or was that just one of the sections that was moved over?
Okay, well, I just checked section 15. The 15. This is, for the most part, still existing legislation. We've made a few little changes here because of some of the things we've done with making the goals voluntary, for instance. We had to reword some of the sections here. Mm-hmm. But right now, we already do require that if a jurisdiction such as Seattle, such as Clark County, such as the Tri-Cities area, if they send waste to Oregon, to one of our regional landfills, they need to have a program similar to the sort of programs we require here. And that's been in law for quite a few years.
Okay. And then also in Section 9, it's talking about the adopting the methods for calculating recovery rates. Are those don't seem to be changes. I think those are the same, but I just want to clarify that. In Section 9.
No, Section 9 is actually, that is a new a new section.
Okay.
And that is one that deals with what I was referring to, having the goals based on actual environmental outcomes, such as energy. We currently measure everything based on weight, which means that a material like plastic, which is very light, has very little value, when in fact plastic is hugely expensive as far as the amount of energy it takes to produce. And so we would much rather recycle a whole lot more plastic than we would like to recycle, for instance, gypsum wallboard or something like that, which has very little value, unless you can recycle gypsum wallboard back to make new gypsum wallboard, and a lot of it just ends up going into compost or something like that. So. Mm-hmm.
And for the things that were the reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, the reductions in emissions of toxic or potentially toxic chemicals and water conservation, were there any other ones that were discussed in the work groups, or was that those?
Those are the main ones. We're limited based on where you can actually find real data. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of data on energy. That's why we picked energy first. There's a fair amount of data on greenhouse gases, so that might be something we have the option of looking at. But as far as the other ones, it gets very confusing when you get into toxics and water issues and so on. And so we're going to need to spend considerable time looking at those and figuring out if there's a way we can actually measure them before we proceed with that.
Yeah. And then this was originally 1983, last updated in 1991. So is this the first update since then, or has there been?
Well, there have been other updates along the way. 1997 was when we added the credit programs, for instance. And 2001 were the last sets of goals, I believe, was there. But there have been occasional updates throughout. But as far as major things goes, we go all the way back to 1983 with the original opportunity to recycle as the basis, and 1991 when we added a whole bunch of other aspects of the main things were there.
Okay. Thank you very much for all the work on this. It's a really big bill, but a lot of thought going into updating it, so appreciate that.
Thanks
so much.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Mark Nystrom, Randy Tucker, and Willie Tiffany for the next panel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. And just heads up, I'm going to probably leave before the panel is done just for another meeting that I've got, if that's okay. But I'll be here if you have any questions at the end of my testimony. I wanted to just express Metro's strong support for Senate Bill 263. Many of my colleagues were involved in the stakeholder efforts that DEQ undertook in the development of this legislation, and it was a robust process, and we're satisfied that it was a good process. The process of developing this legislation continued through the Senate, as the last panel mentioned, and we believe there's consensus now in support of the legislation. We support the provisions that, including the new goals that are going to apply to Metro. We believe, with a lot of strong collaboration and innovation between Metro and its local government partners, we can achieve those goals. And we do expect to play a significant role in helping the state achieve the new goals of this legislation related to food waste and carpet and plastic. So. In sum, we strongly support the legislation and urge an aye vote.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. Our association did have concerns with the originally introduced Senate Bill 263 and probably instigated the amendments that were arrived at, and we are fully supportive. I'd just like to point out for the committee some of the issues that were changed from the original version to the subsequent A engrossed version. And one of those changes was on the multi-tenant provision, the mandate. We suggested that provision be eliminated, but compromised to have a report back to the legislature in 2019 so that if we find that there are problems in implementing that mandate, that the legislature would have an opportunity to amend the statute at that point in time. We also asked for a provision that clarified that the recovery rates with respect to energy output expressly include methane recovery at landfills and fleet conversions for solid waste vehicles from diesel to CNG, and that was included. Third, We asked for a procedure by which the next round of goal setting, so if the department does seek to change the goals in the future, that there be express process by which they do so, which includes locally elected officials in each of the county watersheds. Fourth, we asked for the carpet goal to be moved back to 2025. The department agreed to do that and increase that goal to 25%. In the original bill, it was 12% by 2020. We just thought it would be very, very difficult to meet that goal by 2020. Asked for that to be moved back and agreed to upping it from 12% to 25%. And the most important issue from our perspective was to expressly clarify that the waste recovery goals are indeed voluntary. So there is a provision in the A and Gross version that expressly states that the recovery goals are voluntary in nature and can't be used for regulatory purposes. I want to give a lot of credit for the other stakeholders, including my friends up here, and in particular the department for working with us in good faith in coming to this compromise. And we're happy to support the bill as it is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, Mark Nystrom, Association of Oregon Counties. I'll keep it really short. AOC supports this bill. I'd like to echo what both Randy and Willie said. DEQ was fantastic at being responsive and addressing the concerns of the counties as we went through this whole process. I think there was something like 22 meetings to get to the two bills that are working their way through right now. It was a very comprehensive program, and we really do feel like the products that we have in front of us are a consensus, and we do support the bill. On a side note, Representative Holvey, if you want to talk about food compost, I can help you in Eugene. My wife's the commercial compost coordinator for the city of Eugene, so I have some information for you.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you all very much for your testimony and for your work in the work group.
Yep.
All right, next we have Megan Ponder and Mike Dewey. And if there's anyone else here who'd like to testify on this bill, please come forward. Welcome.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Megan Ponder. I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Recyclers. I've submitted written comments, so I'll keep my comments today brief and summarize those. The Association of Oregon Recyclers is a trade association focused on waste prevention and recycling in Oregon, and AOR supports Senate Bill 263. As you've heard today, this bill is the process of, or the result of a multi-year stakeholder process to evaluate potential updates to Oregon's existing solid waste and recycling laws. AOR members have played a key role in the development of this bill and participated in a number of DEQ work groups and provided ongoing feedback to the proposals. This bill reflects stakeholder input and represents many points of compromise. Sorry. So, in summary, AOR supports Senate Bill 263.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Mike Dewey on behalf of Waste Management. And I was actually involved in 1991 on the original piece of legislation. We are happy to have the opportunity to speak here in support of the bill. We are also, Waste Management is a member of ORA and appreciate their work with DEQ. We're a fairly large company nationally, internationally, and in Oregon operating landfills, transfer stations. We have major collection facilities, transfer stations, and in the Forest Grove area and also in Portland, we are converting the diesel trucks over time to compressed natural gas. It's a fairly expensive proposition regarding the fueling station, and actually the type of employee you need on, working in the on these trucks is totally different in terms of their retraining. We have about 87 of 160 trucks that are in operation that have already been converted, or new trucks in terms of compressed natural gas. With regard to the landfills, we do receive waste from Seattle, And we have a contract with the City of Seattle, the Power District, to send electricity from the methane production, the turbines that we have, to Seattle. So that's kind of a nice thing to do. And the Yamhill County landfill also provides electricity to, I think it's about 3,000 residents in the city of McMinnville. So those are the opportunities in this bill in terms of also the energy credits. So with that, I just wanted to give you that further information. And I will say one last thing. The company has made a lot of investments in material recovery facilities, and this is not easy. Collecting it is easy. It is what you do with it next. And most people want to keep it out of a landfill. We get that. So we're investing in these technologies, but to get them commercial is very difficult to make sure we can work with the rates. And so we continue to do that, but there is not a panacea for plastics that you cannot recycle today. We're trying to get there. The reason carpet has been pushed back is there's not a facility that we can really operate and make it commercially viable in the state of Oregon. So those are the reasons why on some of this we go a little bit slow, because that's the reality. You have to have a homogeneous material to make a lot of this work. By virtue of taking food waste out of the system, we're going to get there. But that's pretty slow in terms of how you do that and how it affects the rates. So we're going to continue to make those investments, but it has been challenging to make this commercial so that the shareholders will look at it and say, this is going to work. So I just wanted to put that on the record because, as I say, it is challenging, but companies are making these investments. Metro actually has an RFP out, or it's actually an RFI, a request for information about what viable companies would do in the metro region for material recovery facilities. And that's going to be kind of interesting to see what the various companies' ideas are going to come out in these public documents. So with that, Madam Chair, I will stop. And if there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Rudin.
Just a comment. I've been reading the book on Tom McCall, The Fire at Eden's Gate, which is a fantastic book if you haven't read it. But it talks a lot about how environmental issues were approached back in the late 60s, early 70s. And it was just a bit more contentious. So I'm really touched, frankly, by the obvious amount of cooperation, the maturity that we have now, and how we approach these problems of environmental stewardship. And so I just really appreciate the work that you've done and the agency's done and helping solve these problems. So.
Well, if I may, very quickly, Representative Reardon, Madam Chair, DEQ, Metro for Waste Management, cities and counties are partners of ours. And we're not obliged. We want to have these conversations because we work with them every day and we're trying to educate them as they are us, but they are our partners.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mike, maybe you know the answers, maybe you don't, but for that carpet that we're keeping out of the landfills, where is it going as we wait for a solution, or is there already a solution in place for how to deal with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm not the expert on carpet. There's a carpet that's getting into the landfills. I mean, there's no question about that today. The issue is how you collect it and recover it and getting enough to make it work. We just don't have a technology that is you got to take the ratepayer in mind, and these facilities cost a lot of money. And you want to be very comfortable that you're going to, for example, contaminated carpet. Unfortunately, there's more of that than you'd think. Hmm. Well, you don't need that. So then you've got less carpet. On plastics, a lot of it is contaminated. So what do you do with that? Well, it needs to go to a landfill. So that's what's been the challenge on all of this. And even food waste is not easy. City of Portland has a mandatory food waste, or it's pretty mandatory. Yeah. And, you know, that seems to be working pretty well.
And then obviously part of the issue is the not in my backyard scenario, too, for the deposition of some of these materials as well. It's just plain hard to find a place to process them, I would imagine.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, one of the questions in the RFI with Metro is what kind of land use work have you done to site a facility? And we all know that, you know, the Oregon land use statutes are complicated. It's not easy to cite some controversial facilities. So that's a challenge that that we will have as we move forward to not only collect but recover this in a way that makes sense, because boutiques are not going to work at the end of the day. They work well in Europe, but the way we're configured, they don't work here in Oregon.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you both
thank you very much for
your testimony. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 263A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 259A. Beth, can you provide the committee with a little summary of this Senate bill?
Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 259A would authorize the Energy Facilities Siting Council to compensate state agencies or local governments incurring expenses directly related to the evaluation or evaluation activities for consultation initiated by an applicant for a notice of intent or request for expedited review prior to the submittal of the notice or request. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal.
Okay,
Madam Chair, this is the Senate for which it's been a while. I opened 59, not 49.
There you go. Just off by 10. All right, thank you. We have Todd Cornett from ODO to talk to us about Senate Bill 259A. Welcome. You get settled, and I think there's a PowerPoint. There we go.
Good afternoon. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, Todd Cornett, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Energy. So I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 259A. The Oregon Department of Energy supports the bill, but as I understood, it would be helpful to kind of begin the testimony with an overview of the Energy Facility Siting Council process. And so I will begin with that, which is what the PowerPoint presentation is largely about. So my intent with this presentation is to give you a high-level overview. I'm sure it won't seem like a high-level overview, but really that's what it is. If during my presentation anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer, delve any deeper into any of the specific issues. So our process starts, like many, with an overall policy, and that is a comprehensive system for the siting, monitoring, and regulating of the location, construction, and operation of all energy facilities in the state. So really the important component there is a comprehensive system, and so as I continue my presentation, think about that and you'll see how that kind of reflects in how our process works. So the process started originally in 1971 with the Nuclear and Thermal Energy Council. The first site certificate that was issued was for the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant. That commission or council was replaced in 1975 by the Energy Facility Siting Council. So it's been that body since then, and the Department of Energy was created at that point in time. So the process in different iterations, but the process has been around for about 40 years. So the process really starts with the decision makers, and the decision makers are the Energy Facility Siting Council. this is a 7-member board or council. They're appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. Like others, they serve 4-year terms, and they term limit after 2 terms. They're lay individuals, although some have some pretty significant energy background. They're broadly representative of the state from a geographic standpoint, and then also fairly diverse in terms of their professional backgrounds as well. They are the decision makers. So throughout the process, everything ultimately culminates with recommendations to them, and they are the decision makers. So the Department of Energy are staff to that. My division, the siting division, we are the primary staff to the council. We work with the applicants. We work with the stakeholders, the public, the state agencies, local governments. We do the analysis, make the recommendations. But again, ultimately, it is the council that makes the decision. Our process is a consolidated review, and this I'll come back to this probably several times in my presentation. The importance there is any state agency, any local government that would have had jurisdiction or a permit or standards or policies that apply to that facility in that location fold into the Energy Facility Siting Council process. So, and I'll talk about that farther or in more detail as we move along. It's a standards-based process. So if you look at the details, as I describe it later, if you're familiar with NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, it sounds a little bit like NEPA, but it really functions more like the state land use system. So if you're familiar with that, being a standards-based process, it's a little more tricky to establish the standards. I'll talk about that. But once those are set for that particular facility, the burden of proof is on the applicant to show that they meet all of those standards, but if they can meet that burden of proof, the council has an obligation to give them an approval. It's a lot more complicated than that, obviously, but that is the basic kind of concept. At the end of the process, if it's approved, a site certificate is issued. This is functionally like a permit or an approval, but it has different legal implications. So the chair of the siting council on behalf of the state of Oregon signs the agreement, the site certificate, with the site certificate holder. So it's really a business contract between the state of Oregon and the site certificate holder and the facility owner and operator at that point. And then application fees are also an important part, where a fee for service sort of function. So any time that we, the Department of Energy, spend on these facilities, we bill them. Our DOJ counsel direct bill to them. Any third-party contractors we have is all directly billable to the applicant, and they are required to pay those. So in terms of that, we do track our time very closely. We have time tracking systems. We function somewhat like attorneys, not quite as detailed, but something like that. So if requested, we can provide fairly detailed information to an applicant on a weekly, daily basis about the costs associated with their facility. And we evaluate on a weekly basis where we're at with every facility in terms of the estimated cost versus the actual cost. So we have a pretty good up-to-date process. And then we invoice them on a monthly basis. Jurisdictionally, it all starts with ORS 469-311. And what this is the definition of an energy facility. And so that functions as the state jurisdictional threshold. So if you look at that statute, it lists all the different types of energy facilities that are under the jurisdiction of the council and whatever the threshold, whether it's a megawatt threshold, a distance threshold, an acreage threshold. So anything that's not within that jurisdictional threshold would be a local jurisdictional, a city or a county jurisdictional facility. And so if you drive out in the gorge and you see all of the wind facilities, some of them are state jurisdictional and some of them are local jurisdictional facilities. It just depended upon the size when they came in. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission also has some jurisdictional authority related to energy-related, energy-type facilities, interstate pipelines, others, wind FERC exerts jurisdiction, FERC has jurisdiction. That's essentially the way we look at it. I'm not going to go through all of these, but it gives you kind of a laundry list of the types of facilities that fall within the council's jurisdiction. In the last decade, it's been primarily wind, thermal, gas, as well as biomass. We have a large transmission line right now, which is about 300 miles long. So other ones, surface facilities related to underground natural gas storage. I won't go through the rest of them, but the one important point at the very bottom, you can see not hydroelectric. Those are Oregon Water Resources Department. And as we're moving forward with offshore energy, that would be the Department of State Lands. So that also would not be the Energy Facility Siting Council. So reviewing agencies, and this is really kind of getting into the importance of Senate Bill 259. So reviewing agencies are those state agencies, local governments, tribal governments, federal agencies, and others affected by the proposal. And that term is used, it means that we send information out, when an applicant sends us information or when we produce information, we send information out to those reviewing agencies at multiple steps along the way, and we request their review, their analysis, and their response back to us about any issues they have, any standards that they would apply if they were reviewing it, any conditions that they would apply. So they're very much an integral part, particularly state agencies, local governments. Well, they're all very important, but local governments and state agencies, as I said, their processes, their standards, their permits get folded into our process. So we really rely upon their expertise. We don't have expertise in all the things that they do. So we rely upon their providing that input to our process to make sure that we're doing it correctly, that we're incorporating all of their issues in a correct manner. Tribes as well as at the very beginning of the process, the Legislative Commission on Indian Affairs determines which of the nine identified tribes in Oregon are affected by that proposed facility based upon the location. They are also a reviewing agency. They also receive all of the information. There is the ability for, at least currently, state agencies and local governments to receive reimbursement for any of the review and response that they provide to us. It's limited, again, to local governments and state agencies, so not all reviewing agencies are eligible. But the way it works is, on a biennial basis, we can enter into a reimbursement agreement with those state agencies and local governments, and they are authorized to request reimbursement from us, but only it's limited to whenever we request their review on a particular item. So they don't have broad authority to submit invoices. They submit invoices based upon, you know, work that they've done on our request. They are limited by that. They provide them on a monthly basis. We review those invoices pretty carefully within the department, and we pay them, and then we turn around and then bill the applicant for those costs. Like reviewing agencies, public stakeholders are also a very important part of our process. So they receive information at least four times during the process, and because they're such an important element to our process, we've really, in the last couple of years, looked for ways that we can better educate them. It's a complicated process. It takes a long time. We recognize that there's long gaps in time. So we've done several things. We hope we've heard that it's been helpful to better educate them, to be more transparent about how our process works. A couple of examples are they can sign up to receive email notifications. So any single project, any combination of projects, anytime there's a notification, they can sign up and manage that themselves to receive those notifications. We have all of our council meetings now on webinar. So because our council meetings occur throughout the state, if somebody's interested in tracking our projects or council meetings, they can participate remotely and not have to travel hundreds of miles to go to these council meetings. Also, on our website, we've completely redone the way the project pages are. So it starts out with the entire process laid out with explanation, and then as we progress along, the notices, the meetings, the documents, the applications, the documents that we produce all start to become available on that website. So essentially, just about everything associated with that project is available. It's a lot of information. It certainly can be overwhelming, but if somebody wants to dig in, it's all there and available for them. So our review standards, there's two broad categories of standards. One of the one of the attachments that was sent includes a list of the standards, the council standards. So there's a host of energy facility citing council standards that are in our rules, but we also include state laws and local ordinances other than local land use regulations. So it's kind of the one big pot. The other is local land use regulations specifically. So those are the land use, local land use and development ordinances and any comprehensive plan provisions. Again, those all get incorporated at the very beginning stages into the process. It is important to note that while it is a consolidated review, there is an option for the applicant to choose local government review for the local land use regulation process. So at the beginning, prior to submitting their preliminary application, they make that choice. Frankly, they never make the choice to go for the local land use regulation. They always choose FSEC because of the consolidated nature. The whole purpose of our process is to reduce or eliminate duplication so that we're not on different appellate paths, that we don't have different decisions, different conditions. And so I think most applicants recognize that and choose to go through the full consolidated review instead of the local land use path.
And Ted, I want to make sure we have time to discuss the bill too, so if you could just...
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure, and that's actually kind of, this next slide is sort of a point, a decision point in terms of the presentation. So this lays out the entire steps in the process. The remainder of the slides go through more detail of steps in the process. So I'm happy to conclude it here and get into the bill itself, or I can hit a couple of the highlights of the process which relate to the bill.
Why don't you go ahead and talk about how this slide relates to the bill and where it fits in there.
Okay. So the process begins at the very beginning with a notice of intent. This is a very general document which indicates the location of the project, but it's without having the applicant having to do all the studies, all the effort and work. It allows them to submit the information to us. We provide notice. We get it out to the state agencies, local governments, the public. People have an opportunity to chime in. That allows us to then establish what the standards are for that particular facility. Again, it's locational. It's specific. That's what comes out in the project order, what the standards are for that facility. The applicant then goes away 2 months, 3 months, a year and a half, and ultimately submits the preliminary application. And they're responding to the information in the project order. We evaluate that in a preliminary fashion and then ultimately determine whether or not it's complete. After that, we, the department, create a findings of fact document. So it's an analysis of what the applicant submits compared to what the standards are, and that's the draft proposed order. Once we issue that, we also have a public hearing. That public hearing is an opportunity for anybody who has concerns about the project to raise issues. And that's an important point, because if somebody who has concerns about the project fail to raise those issues during the comment time frame for that hearing, they cannot continue to participate in the process. So they have to raise an issue, and it has to be within the jurisdiction of the council for them to participate at the next stage. And that next stage is, we take the information from the hearing, we basically redo the draft proposed order into the proposed order. We notice that, and then people have an opportunity to raise issues and request party status in a contested case. That contested case is an administrative law process. We hire an independent hearings officer. They're not staff. It's not a requirement, but they're attorneys. It's really an administrative law proceeding. So they're very independent, and they focus in on the issues that were raised during the draft proposed order hearing. Ultimately, the contested case concludes. That, as well as the proposed order, goes to the council. They make a determination on whether or not to approve the facility. If they do, then they issue a final order and site certificate, and that is challengeable directly to the Oregon Supreme Court. And the statute has a six-month time frame from the date that it's challenged for the Supreme Court to issue their final decision. So that, in a nutshell, is the steps in the process.
Thank you so much for doing that.
So getting to the bill, so that concludes. I'll just leave it at that one. So getting to the bill itself, there are four really substantive elements that I wanted to provide to the committee today. And the first is related to the notice of intent. So prior to the notice of intent, we frequently now have applicants come to us and want to have conversations with some of the state agencies or local governments. They may have concerns about an issue. They'd like to get something looked at. They'd like to get a response back from a state agency because even though the notice of intent can be adjusted, it's easier to try to resolve those issues or avoid those issues altogether. So we frequently get those questions. The statute does not currently expressly allow for reimbursement prior to the submittal of the notice of intent. The language in the statute says reimbursement to state agencies and local governments is only available once the notice of intent is submitted. So the first proposal would be to allow for pre-consultation prior to the notice of intent. That would be initiated by the applicant. That would be directed by the applicant. It would not be a requirement. There would be a cost estimate that would be produced by the Department of Energy staff. That would have to be agreed to by the applicant, and that the costs included in that cost estimate could not be exceeded unless agreed to by the applicant. So this is entirely driven by them, for them, and if they choose not to do it, then that's fine as well. Then the process would start at the notice of intent. So that's the first thing. The second is at the very end, once a site certificate is issued, we, the Department of Energy, have compliance obligations. There are numerous conditions associated with every facility. It requires us to go out and do site inspections to review documents. Because the state agencies and local governments, they may have conditions that they provided to us. They may have permits that they have to issue as a result of the council's decision. They also have compliance obligations. So we rely upon them as well to ensure some of these conditions are met, either going out and assisting us with doing a site inspection or reviewing documents. So the second substantive element of the bill would allow for those state agencies and local governments to get reimbursement for that work after a site certificate is issued. Like the first issue, that's not currently expressly allowed in statute. The third substantive issue is related to tribal governments. As I had indicated, there are nine identified tribal governments in Oregon that could be affected by these site certificate applications. They're identified early on in the process. We provide information to them. They provide very important evaluation and comments to us based upon their expertise on protected cultural, historic, archaeological, and treaty rights resources. So that happens now. It's an obligation. We're required to send that information to them. There is no allowance for them in statute to get reimbursed for that, for their review and comment to us. So the third element of the bill, we would include a provision to allow us to enter into an agreement, a reimbursement agreement with them. And like I described with state agencies, they would be limited in terms of the timing, the scope, and then it's also timely invoicing, submitting timely invoices to us as well. And then the fourth element, this was not part of the original bill, but for the A and Gross version, these came out after the bill was introduced, and based on our several meetings between us and representatives of the investor-owned utilities, they were interested in, and we were accepting of the removing the ability for state agencies and local governments to get reimbursement for legal expenses if they participated as a party in a contested case. So as I described, in a contested case, typically it's anybody who's challenging that facility would raise an issue and request party status in a contested case. With state agencies and local governments, there are at least five definitive times within the process that we reach out to them and solicit their input. With some agencies, we do it more so because there's a lot of things that we have to resolve. So there's lots of opportunities prior to a contested case to resolve issues, which we really attempt to do by working well with our sister agencies. So if a state agency was requesting party status and was participating in a contested case, it almost certainly would be in opposition. And so the change would not allow for their reimbursement by the applicant of legal expenses for their participation in that contested case. It would still allow for staff time reimbursement, but it just would not allow for legal expense reimbursement. So those are the four substantive elements. We also made some other changes, but really more related to flow, where we broke a couple of things out. So these were the big substantive elements, and with that, I will conclude my testimony and entertain any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Cornett? Representative Benson.
As we discussed in my office, I was going to ask what the review methodology was in the event someone was unhappy with whatever the amount might be that was suggested as the amount the department needs.
Chair Rega Peterson, Representative Benz. So for the application process, so once we enter into the application process, in order, prior to even an applicant submitting their preliminary application, they have to request a cost estimate from us. In that cost estimate, we scope out the entire cost for the entire process. That includes whatever we know at that point in time, whether we think there's going to be a contested case. Frankly, it's hard to determine how significant it's going to be, but we scope out each kind of milestone, each phase in the process. We evaluate and try to determine what our costs are going to be, what our DOJ costs are going to be, what our state agency costs are going to be. That agreement has to be signed by the applicant as well. But on a kind of an individual basis, what we do is we, again, track our time. So we have a timekeeping system, so we track our time. If the questions arise about where we spend our time on a particular day, then we have that ability to respond and say what we did. If an applicant challenges that there's a statutory provision, ORS 469-441, which states that all charges or costs have to be reasonable, just, and necessary. If an applicant feels that those costs are not, you know, all three of those, they can then come back to us. The burden is then on us to justify it. And if we continue to say that it's reasonable, just, and necessary, and they feel they want to challenge it, then that challenge would go to the circuit court. So that's the steps in the process. We do look at every invoice that comes in from all the state agencies with a lot of scrutiny, and frankly, we look at all of our costs with a lot of scrutiny as well.
Thank you. The group to whom you appeal the matter, there is no group. In other words, if someone wants to challenge it, they actually have to go to court. Is that what it ends up being? If someone is unhappy with whatever the amount may be, you say, well, pay it or else. What do they? What's the or else?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz. Yes. So the ultimate would be that they would have to take it to the circuit court if they wanted to challenge that. But the reality is, and we've had several applicants do this, come back and challenge in, you know, costs that we've submitted to them, and it's either been based upon our discussion with them, describing exactly what was done, how it was done, why it was done, that they've agreed to that, or there have been certainly times where we've agreed with their challenge and said, no, we're not going to charge you those costs. So, so far in my experience, those have been resolved without having the applicant needing to go to circuit court.
Thank you. Okay.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does your agency ever ask other agencies, like, I'll just give an example, ODF&W, to come in and assess something and then not pay them? Or how does that work? Do you pay for those kinds of analyses?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Boone. So all of our sister agencies, we have agreements with 11 different sister agencies. Only three of them invoice us consistently, ODFW, DSL, probably Dogami. The other ones don't invoice us. So they have the opportunity. We do state agency training every year, so we try to make sure that we get the information out to all the different staff members, because we recognize that staff members change. We heavily rely upon these state agencies to help us to help this process work the way it's designed to work. So to incent them, this bill is one of those things. We've done, as I'd indicated for the public, we've done a lot of things for state agencies to try to better educate them, inform them, have them prepared. The financial opportunities or reimbursement is one of those things. So we've done a lot in the last year to make sure that if they would like to get reimbursed, there is every opportunity for them to get reimbursed.
But they have to make an arrangement with you in order to do that. Okay.
Yeah, Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Boone. Yeah, we have to enter into an interagency agreement for reimbursement, and then following their doing whatever the work is, they would need to submit an invoice to us. So through our Central Services Department, then would run it through us, and then we would validate it, run it back down, and then we would pay them.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Todd, I'm picking up on the comments by Representative Bentz. I want to make sure my understanding of the proposed legislation is correct. If an applicant wants to come in before the notice of intent and do some pre-work with you, you provide them with an estimate of cost. If they don't like the cost, there's not only the option of challenging the cost estimate in circuit court, but they can also just sidestep that whole process and roll the dice, go ahead and say, we want you to issue the notice of intent, and then we'll be back with our application in a few months or years, right?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Helm, somewhat. So the whole point of this pre-consultation is for their benefit. So if they come to us and ask, we would like to work with these three state agencies, and these are the questions that we would like to ask, we will reach out to those state agencies and solicit from them what they think those costs are going to be, and then provide those into a cost estimate. If the applicant doesn't like that, at that point, that's not challengeable because those costs haven't been incurred yet. So that statutory provision wouldn't kick in. We would have to enter an agreement. So, I would think that, if they had concerns, then we would try to resolve those concerns and either reduce the scope to be consistent with the amount that they were interested in paying, or explain to them, the reason why that cost estimate was, as it was included. So, but yes, if they decided that, the cost did not outweigh the benefits, then they could simply not engage those state agencies and then put together all of the elements in the notice of intent, which is really how the project process is designed, that's the first step.
Just a follow-up, short follow-up. So, what was one of the concerns that I maybe heard in Representative Bent's comments is the cost estimate wouldn't ever be a procedural bar to an applicant going ahead with an application.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Helm, no. The cost estimate, just to be clear, there are two cost estimates kind of in the process that we're talking about. One would be prior to the notice of intent,
right,
and that would be entirely at the request of the applicant and their choice. They don't have to go through that. Once we get into the application phase, that's a requirement. They have to request the cost estimate. We have to provide the cost estimate. Ultimately, we have to sign that agreement, that cost reimbursement agreement, so that we're both agreed that, this is what we said it was going to cost. This is what they're agreeing to pay. And then if we get to the point where we think we're going to go over that, we have to then reach out to the applicant, make them aware of it, and reestablish a new cost estimate.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. And we have Varner Seaman signed up to testify, and if anyone else would like to, they can come up at this time.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. Thanks for the opportunity to testify briefly on this piece of legislation. The very short version is that PG supports this bill, and we appreciate the Department of Energy's willingness to work with us on the bill, as Todd has discussed, going through some back and forth and discussions about how the process should work. With that said, we raised one note in the Senate hearing, and we're continuing to work on, and we would actually like to bring forward an amendment on this bill related to one sort of very technical part and kind of a somewhat picayune concern around this. The way I would characterize the change that Todd was just talking about with the pre-notice of intent consultation with agencies, I'll use some less formal language around it. It's essentially, it's sort of, as we talk about in Oregon, we talk about sometimes there are meetings, then there's pre-meeting for meeting, there's pre-meeting before the pre-meeting before the meeting. Maybe this is the pre-meeting before the meeting. And essentially what the opportunity is if you're looking at developing a project and you've got maybe a site A, B, and C, it can be advantageous for a proponent to say, why don't we try to get some conversation with some of the agencies to figure out, is there a big species of concern issue at one of these sites, so that we would know that, you know, if site A had a bunch of Washington ground squirrel habitat and population, probably don't want to try to develop a project there. Let's go look at site B or C. Generally speaking, the way that this pre-meeting that we're talking about here would work is that we would work out what the schedule of payments would need to be with Department of Fish and Wildlife in this hypothetical. We'd have some conversations with them. They may go out in the field a little bit and come back and say, okay, yep, site A, you know, you're going to run into some issues. B and C look like you're probably going to have some less concerns there. We would like to have an amendment that would have some different standards in terms of disclosure for these types of consultations in the prior to notice of intent. If you end up going forward with a notice of intent, it's clearly a public process, lots of opportunity for folks to comment, lots of opportunity for folks to intervene, lots of opportunity for engagement. In these pre-notice of intent consultations, we do think it's appropriate to have some different standards of disclosure and to have some of those consultations be able to be confidential. Essentially, if you're going to go forward and look at a site, I mean, in this hypothetical, and you say site A is a bad site, there are some species of concern there, and you end up not going forward with that, we don't necessarily think that that should have the same types of public disclosure that a full notice of intent and the full process should have. So we're going to be working on seeing if we can come up with an amendment in that direction. Otherwise, we think this is a good bill. We support FSEC's work. We don't necessarily think that there are problems with, to be fair, the FSEC process is pretty expensive. When you go through the full process, it's a pretty robust permitting regime. We think that's appropriate. It is the permitter pays as opposed to the rest of the taxpayers paying. We think that's a pretty good system. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Werner? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Look forward to the amendment. And with that, we are through with people signed up to testify. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 259A. Colleagues, we will not be having a meeting on Thursday afternoon because we don't have that much to do, and we did great work today. For those of us on revenue, I think we're having a longer revenue meeting, so no fun there. But but for the rest of you, a couple hours off. So thanks so much. And with that, I'm closing the meeting on the House Energy and Environment Committee. Environment Committee.